Fantastic. So we're recording, huh?
Yes.
Amazing. And we even got a little intro music and everything with this conference call. So this is the show. This is it. This is show number one. My show, people. And Bob Dobbs is on the line. Aren't you, Bob?
Yes, I'm here.
So I wanted to make this sort of a primer for the little man, if you want to call it that. I want you to tell people who have no idea who you are or what you're about, who you are and what you're about. And, you know, because you have a sort of a loyal, small following, or small to medium to large, maybe.
Yeah.
Following. But there's many other people who wouldn't stumble across you that maybe they should. So you give us your mainstream profile, Bob.
I worked in intelligence for many years. My birthday, 90th birthday, is coming up in a couple of weeks, February 2nd. And so I've seen a lot of the 20th century. I've interacted with the scum of the earth, the geniuses of our time, the average people of our time, and phenomenal otherworldly phenomena. So I have a unique repertoire of ammunition and experience and knowledge to interact with anybody. And I'm the most amazing person you're ever going to hear talk. I may not be the greatest guitarist on the planet, the greatest painter, the greatest movie director, but I am a fucking amazing speaker.
So you hold yourself up to be, let's say, a master conversationalist?
Yes, a master conversationalist. And I agree with Marshall McLuhan. I think conversation is the best medium, the best art form. It's the cheapest. It's the most comprehensive, especially when you're in person with somebody. But the advantage of not being in person and being on the phone, on the air, discarded, electrified, is you're not distracted by body language. So we can really get into the resonances of words without the other immediate chemical body, tactile, ESP, mental dance, gestural stuff that happens when you're interacting with somebody. But this way, it is tactile because it's an electric environment, but it's really more based on the ear, not all the senses, where ordinary interaction with the chemical bodies, with speech, involves all the senses.
Right. They say that, in the ballpark of 90% of person-to-person communication is in the body language, if you're face-to-face, of course.
Yeah.
Or even through TV and all that sort of thing, over video conference maybe. And
listen to this. McLuhan's that part. It's called nonverbal mental dance or nonverbal mental gesture. Either way, that's a good expression of what you call that interaction. You know what I mean? You're calling body language. It's more than just your physical senses. There's the non-physical senses interacting, the sixth sense, the intuition going. The nonverbal mental gesture is maybe a better phrase than body language.
It really is sort of a dance. I mean, what is dancing other than nonverbal physical communication and unison, rhythm, synchronization?
It's a drama. It's a drama. I did an essay called Cloning ESP, and I begin with this drama. If I was in your presence, I'd say something to you. Then I'd see what is the range of possibilities you are going to express based on what I know from before about you. Or if I don't know you, I don't know how you're going to do it. And then I'm quickly thinking and getting ready to respond to how you respond. It's a very attentive situation if you're interested in the person you're talking to. So that's the drama, right? I'm looking at you and watching, and I don't know myself until I hear your response to me. You can see my face. I can't see it. So I judge what I am based on your response to my responses to you.
Right. That's communication, I would say, in essence, right? And that's your specialty.
What kind of communication?
Well, I would say communication is defined as a two-way street, constant feedback and response between two or more parties.
Yes.
That's what it is. You know, it's not just – I'm talking to you, and that's it. That's sort of the academic means of communication, if you want, the teacher lecturing. But real communication is the constant dance, the constant back and forth.
Yeah, it's a dance. It's not talking at you. I'm a very good listener, which means watching your reactions if I'm in person with you. And not judging everything that you seem to be saying. It actually involves a non-thinking or non-concluding. I just stay there and see how long we can interact.
Yeah, exactly. How long is it going to go on for, Bob?
Yeah.
So let me back up a bit. And
if you remember, have you ever read my famous interview with Frank Zappa?
I was reading, I can't claim to have read it, but I saw something just recently today, I believe, that was posted about it. Yeah.
I think I posted it or on Facebook. If you're tracking my Facebook, I'm talking to the author of one of the best books in Zappa, maybe the best book, by his former secretary executive assistant, Pauline Butcher. And I pointed out some quotes from my interview, but it ends with me saying to Frank, so this conversation, this is after 3.5 hours, so this conversation is going to go on forever. And I felt prompted to say that because of the complexities we had gotten into sort of philosophically. He says, no, it's going to stop right now. So that's how the interview stops.
I mean, it makes me think of how I can see Zappa now and from a CNN clip in 1986 talking about censorship. And it's like he is going on forever in that sense. He's jumping right from that time to me watching him now, even though his physical body's not here. And I think that's sort of an example of the essence of this electric environment. Not that people may know what we're talking about at all, but
you're right, though. The instant replay is, as McLuhan said, has the most profound metaphysical implications. And that's right. We never left 1945. Once we have electronic recording, any event never can die unless something blows up the electric technology or something. But basically, Frank is here forever now.
Would you say the camera /
the instant replay?
The instant replay
is the most amazing, McLuhan said. It has the most profound metaphysical implications because
now,
it.
I'm sorry.
It brings in that eternal factor you were just mentioning.
Yeah, I remember seeing an actor being interviewed on a talk show one time, and he said the reason I got into acting is so there would be a record of my existence, and it would actually continue. And you know, I can see what he thinks. His physical body will die off, but people will be able to look at him on the screen for, who knows, 50 years, 100 years, until
right
now.
So now that's a common ambition. So we brought in Ion as an anti-environment to say, hey, don't rely on external technology to make yourself be eternal. You can do it in the physical. That's the counter move represented by Ion's options.
Now tell the people, remember we're theoretically talking to the audience here that doesn't know all that much. So tell the people about Ion and also tell them who McLuhan was and how they relate together, because I think they're pretty closely related.
Yes. I often am criticized for quoting McLuhan and not saying original things. For example, I just quoted McLuhan on the instant replay. I could say the instant replay. I could just say, well, the instant replay has profound metaphysical effects. I could say it and not tell you McLuhan said it. But I like to acknowledge who I'm quoting. It doesn't mean that I rely on that. But I think, for the record, he said it first, as far as I know, and I don't mind quoting him. I'm not trying to be original all the time. So some people find it irritating that I'm actually giving my acknowledgments as I go along, like my footnotes. So just want to say that I'm indifferent to people complaining about the fact that I'm quoting someone. I'm only saying, telling them I'm quoting someone so that that person gets the credit.
Yeah, basically, it's certainly better than claiming someone else's quote or idea for oneself.
Right, and I know so many. Yeah,
yeah.
I know so many interesting ideas that the many people don't know, I could get away with saying a lot of this stuff that actually was invented by other people, and no one would know any better, that they would think I was a genius. You know, oh, look, he thought up that, he thought up this. Because a lot of my stuff is not known. You know what I mean? It's, people don't know the stuff. And
well, yeah,
so,
I mean, if you being the intelligence agent, which theoretically would make you privy to insider info and privileged information, I believe they call it, then no one else could know, I think, would be the
right.
Message
but
here.
Even there, today, it just people don't know what Zappa said, what Mae Brussel said, what Lynn LaRouche said, what Marsh McLuhan said, and particular detailed statements. They might have a general impression, oh, Zappa's the guy who ate shit on stage. McLuhan's the guy who was in the Annie Hall movie. LaRouche is some guy who thinks the Queen pushes drugs. They don't know the particulars that these minds have uttered.
You said Zappa ate shit on stage? Is that what you just said?
Oh, yeah. That was a famous rumor that in the early 70s he had a competition with Alice Cooper or somebody about who could gross out who. And so Alice Cooper did something to gross people out, and then Zappa shit on the stage and ate it and won the gross out contest. That was a – Zappa begins his book, his autobiography, you know, clearing that up. That didn't happen.
So why should these particular – I'm a big fan of Zappa, and I can't say – I know the other people you speak of, but I don't know their work in depth. But why should people care – about these individuals more than whoever they care about now?
Well, Americans like to celebrate the individual initiative, the individual creativity, the individual rebel, the guy in the garage inventing, the crank inventor, or what do they call it, some other phrase, the eccentric inventor.
Sure.
That's an archetype in American cultural preference. Don't know if young 20-year-olds are like that now in America. They've been so massaged by the Android meme that they may not have that original American type. But so I say I'm actually preserving the archetypes of American culture by hoiking up these kind of very interesting individualists. That's one agenda.
I see. And, so they are actual individualists. That's sort of the first thing.
They're unique. They act out a kind of American prerogative to be inventive.
All these people were American that you just said?
LaRouche was. LaRouche is. He's still alive. Zappa is. Now, McLuhan was a Canadian, but he was made famous first when he was in the United States. And it's a joke in Canada that a Canadian cannot become famous unless they go to the States and become famous. Then Canadians will acknowledge that they were Canadians and famous. So there's a whole thing about McLuhan spending many years in the States, and he was the expert on the archetypes of American culture. So he may not have been physically born in the United States, but he married an American and understood the culture. Okay, so you asked me if who was Marshall McLuhan. I think that's what you said. Something about him.
Explain to the little man who he is and also how he connects to this Ion character.
Well, McLuhan was an English professor at the University of Toronto who decided to apply techniques of literary analysis, which are applied to books, but applied it to television, advertising, magazines, movies, and modern post-book media. Beg your pardon?
You would call this the Android meme, basically, right?
Well, that's later. He applied it to the analog media phase in the 40s and 50s, television, movies, magazines, the regular stuff of the 20th century before it all got digitized.
When it was all coming into its own, coming to fruition in the early days. Yes. Okay, so continue.
And he was the first to be an intellectual, a professor who would leave the ivory tower of the university and go on local talk shows in the 50s and 60s and talk about pop culture, about beatniks, about The Twist, about Beatles. And he got a lot of criticism from his colleagues in the University of Toronto and other universities for leaving book culture and adding some kind of dignity or attention to the new pop culture. They didn't like that. And when McLuhan responded, he said, "People think if I talk about something that I'm for it." He says that's not the case in his situation. He's usually against what he talks about, but he does not fear talking about it.
Right. He would go on TV to criticize TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah, whereas the old literary professors would figure TV was just a silly entertainment, masturbation box, and wouldn't give it the time of day, say it's not worth looking or talking about. And they were wrong to have that position.
It was the idea right from the beginning that there was no genuine information to be transmitted through the BookTube whatsoever, which obviously has been a self-fulfilling prophecy for the most part since that time, because obviously there still is pretty much nothing coming through that thing that is of any value, but there's always that something. There's always
Wait a minute. That was McLuhan's uniqueness. He said it doesn't matter what the content of TV is. The very sensory makeup of the machine of television was going to cause profound changes in institutions in America. And he wrote in 1962 that it was futile to discuss the effects of TV in 1962, but the effects of TV will be obvious in 20 years. And one of the main symptoms in American culture was you had the big TV president, Ronald Reagan, came in the early 80s, and he was a TV president who bypassed all traditional political ambitions, platforms, and usual ideology. So Reagan was a fulfillment of McLuhan's prediction that politics would change because of television.
Well, Reagan was the McLuhanite messiah.
Yeah. And, McLuhan in 1975-76 in a People magazine interview, I think it was, predicted that Reagan would be not a great president. He would be a president because he was the perfect actor for the role of being a president. The president must merge with his role and have no private identity, like an actor. So McLuhan said Reagan was the only actor among all the candidates for president in the late 70s, so he will be the best president. And then he became the most suitable for the role. And so he did that. So he predicted Reagan, and Reagan fulfilled McLuhan's prediction.
The president's job is to play the president, right?
Yes. Not to have any private opinions, not even to change the world. You're just there to represent the people of the United States. That's all you're there for.
They don't necessarily want to change the world too much.
Right. Well, you represent American interests. And, of course, that's impossible to do by the 80s in the globalized situation.
Aha,
beg your pardon?
Explain what you mean by that. It's impossible to represent American interests in the 80s.
Because many of the corporations, as a result of the electric and digital technologies that came in with fiber optics and satellites and computer networks, they operated around the planet by 1980. That was, the Panama Canal thing was dismantled. The NAFTA started, the move to make NAFTA came in. It was becoming a global economy for the corporations who had companies in many countries. So they had to juggle their positions, and they were not just loyal to the United States. The United States as a bounded country was too small to contain the global networks that were being built.
So we made that leap from national governmentism to transnational corporatism.
That was a popular phrase in the 70s, almost 40 years ago. And what people don't know, and this is McLuhan's point, is that think beyond the image of transnational corporatism. These are corporations that are on the phone. And where are you when you're on the phone? You're in a digital membrane, and you can't locate where it is. So all business more and more was happening in this one little membrane.
Mm.
So it wasn't even transnational. It was imploded to a universal membrane.
It turns the nations of the world into one gelatinous amoeba-like substance.
Well, not the nations. It makes the national structures ghettos, and the gelatinous could be Frank Zappa's jelly. That was a symbol he used in the late 60s. The gelatinous or jelly substance that everybody was jumped into, which is just digital O's and ones, that was the new space. And that caused a profound identity crisis for all national institutions all over the planet, including the Soviet Union, which collapsed under that.
Yeah, a decade or so later.
Yeah.
They couldn't go there. Didn't you mention something once? It was the fact that they basically tried to keep so much control broke them into a million pieces. Like they literally couldn't keep up with their electronic monitoring devices.
Yeah, they tried to keep up by running the hardware services in their country and their connections around the world, wherever their empire was. They did not know that the action had moved to the invisible jelly, the digital space. And it didn't matter what armaments had, armaments or tankers and this and that, the hardware stuff that they had managed. And they were trying to preserve that, but it was too slow. It could not keep up with the not even speedy movements at the speed of light, but the actual going nowhere space that is the digital economy, which, by the way, has just collapsed.
Explain what you mean by this visual economy. Exactly. I've heard you
it's
say
typing.
That.
It's typing. Think of day trading. Anybody leave their home when they do day trading? No, they just type.
They sit at home and trade. That's what you
Yeah. And they're interacting with a space that's scanning data all over the planet and all the stock exchanges and all the opportunities in old media that offer shares to trade or stocks to invest in. That is a massive, as McLuhan would call, macroscopic gesticulation, a massive interacting dialogue all over the place in one little membrane at the tip of your fingers. So that's the point. The invisible new space of the economy was hard for the old hardware economies to get beat on, to get to figure out their relationship to. An example would be the early 80s when junk bonds came in. Even the bond market or the stocks themselves were becoming virtual and not really connected to any hardware activities. So you had these great automobile companies collapsing while all this wealth is being produced on the Internet or on the digital communication network. And what was that wealth? It was just transactions. The ecstasy of registering people, watching movies, buying records, buying stocks, you know, just ecstasy of communication. It was the ecstasy of communication.
It's funny what you say this. It makes me think of how they always talk about the bubble. The bubble is going to burst, you know, the housing bubble, the stock bubble. And literally what you're describing is a bubble. It's basically a membrane with a hollow inside. There's nothing there.
And the bubble is a visualization. It's not even an appropriate image. It's very tactile. It's like two people making love. It's very intimate and rubbing and grinding against each other. That's what's going on in the digital economy. They are typing to interfacing with images all over the world. That's a kind of very intimate exchange.
It's human beings interacting with something other than us themselves, another person.
No, let's do it this way. Not interacting with eyeball space or earball space or kinetic moving your muscles. You're sitting there interacting with the delicate movement of your fingers.
That's the tactility.
Typing. Yeah, that's tactility.
And, yeah, I mean, even these new touchscreen devices, they use the electricity from your fingertips to move the screen.
Right.
You know?
Now, that's what we call, McLuhan called haptic. That's not tactile. Tactile is not a sense. It's the interplay of the sense. When we have this hyper-interactivity or tactility, it's been going on for 30 or 40 years. Now when you move into the Minority Report, the beginning of that movie where Tom Cruise is massaging these things with his hands, we'll call that the haptic sense. That is a sense, haptic and proprioceptive.
And that haptic being the actual sense of touch in the electric environment?
It's not touch. Touch is the not a sense. It's the interplay of sense. What people think is touch is when you press against a wall or a solid or a desk or a person, when you're actually making kinetic connection, pressure, that's what people think is touch. They don't know that touch is also the part of when you release your hands from pressing on something and then you release them, then you press again. In that interval of touching and then of pressing and then letting go and then repressing, that's the resonant interval of tactility. It's the space in between. You can't get rhythm otherwise.
So read between the lines in the sense environment.
Don't put that visual metaphor. Dance, think of dancing with your feet. You couldn't dance unless you could remove your foot from the pressure on the floor and then put it down again. It's that up and down, touch and not kinetic sense of touch, kinetic pressure and then not kinetic pressure, like a drummer. That is the best visualization of tactile interplay. But the haptic is when back in the 50s when a guy would shape a sort of mime, a nice figure, 36, 24, 36, and he'd wave his hands down in that hourglass shape,
yes,
or form, the movement of the hand there, that's expressing haptic interface. It's very close to tactility. But when you have Tom Cruise there, you know, shaping masses of patterns with his hands, that is something you can see. You can see his what he's moving about. You can't see in tactility because tactility is not a sense. It's the interconnecting. So haptic is the most visual form of tactility. It's the closest to visualizing. So the new media is haptic, the way you rub your hand over your iPhone.
Right. It's the extension of the tactility, which is the interplay in your brain. It's your response to your environment. And
yeah.
So it reminds me, it's what you say, it's what Ion, to shift back to Ion for a second,
yeah,
what Ion basically said he is when I asked him about himself. He said, in essence, I'm the space, you know, between the spaces there's electricity, even between cells in your body and all that. And so that is what you're describing as the touch, the sort of the dark matter of the touch and the haptic space. It's not just touching, but also when you take your hand off, that's the space between the physical forms of this world. And it's very metaphysical, sort of.
No, hold it. Okay, hold. Don't say any more words. You said a lot of good stuff. Everything you've said is correct. Metaphysical,
okay.
That's a philosophical category. Don't go there. Just describing the interval, the resonant interval in between, is what Ion means by non-physical. For most people, physical is what you see and hear. So non-physical, you can't see and hear. So how can we hear Ion if it's non-physical? Well, we can interact with Ion. If you understand, it's a tactile interplay. It's in the spaces in between. So you have the trinity, the physical, the non-physical, and the labyrinth of the mind. The labyrinth of the mind is the culture that tries to visualize the interplay between what you can see and hear, the physical, and what you can't see and hear, the non-physical. So what you just said, if anybody wanted to go back and listen to it and excerpt that, that's right. That's what Ion is. It's an expression of tactile interplay, but not the kinetic pressure part of tactility.
The non-kinetic interval. So you say the labyrinth of the mind, as you guys refer to it, that's sort of it's the decoder between physical and non-physical. And
that's the mind.
Yeah.
The mind is the limitation that requires judging that the non-physical is something different from the physical. So the tactile interplay that we've set up as a definition of what non-physical is a mental concept for something that is not limited to that. But people like to get a grasp with concepts on what we're doing and what we're referring to. An ion is a miracle, an anomaly in itself, because we're hearing non-physical speak, and Ion grasps for tactile electrical metaphors so we could visualize the non-physical. So what you said 2 minutes ago is perfect, but Ion is more than that, but that's another matter for you to experience.
For each and every one of us,
yeah,
apparently. See, yeah. Now that, I would say, to the average herd, this would be seen as frivolous stuff, and it's you know, they would see it as new agey or metaphysically or whatever you want.
Right. Their mind will put into cultural stereotypes and images that they've been trained by.
Correct.
And then McClone always said, okay, I'm talking about something very practical. You're involved with the telephone every day and with computers and all this electrical technology. Well, you can't see electricity. The only way to understand electricity is it's an interplay between the juxtaposition of certain materials. And that very interplay is how we're defining tactility. So we are describing what people are very involved in, and they can't visualize it. So this is the most practical, empirical thing to discuss is the water you're swimming in. And the electric. Yeah. But I can understand that the American or any culture, based on its bias and the labyrinth of its mind conditioned by that cultural bias, they will want to see it in their cultural terms, see it. They will want to see it. That's a mistake right there.
What is it about our minds that's so shitty and always runs us the wrong way? If it's also this dutiful gift and allows us to think and build things and that sort of stuff. And then why is it so detrimental to your bliss, I guess, your non-physical sort of contentment?
Well, it wasn't a problem for very pre-literate Aboriginal peoples, because Ion says the mind is just the autonomic system, the clicking, the O's and ones within the autonomic breathing and movement of blood. You don't have to think about that. It happens on its own. Now, when you start getting into speech and writing, and then later the printing press, you start to lock down rigid images of the autonomic system or of what you call thinking. And then that's when thinking becomes a problem. That's when the image of the mind's created. And if we don't know that literacy made us, it abstracted the autonomic nervous functioning and measuring by the mind, in other words, a mind that wasn't visualizable, when we start to visualize words and able to relook at words because they've been written down, that abstracts the awareness of the autonomic system into a visual image. And that's what we're calling mind. And if you don't know that's what's happened, you'll get lost in the visual image of the mind. And then over centuries, as you reinforce it with the printing press, you will think that the mind is some abstract mirror. And it isn't.
Yeah, that printing press really guided and shaped how people view everything.
It made everything viewable.
Viewable, right. At all. Yeah.
It made the second look. When people are talking and there's no writing, there's no way to retrieve the talking and get a second look at it other than asking the person to restate what they said. And it's often hard to restate something verbally exactly in the rhythm it was said a minute ago. So you never get an exact replay. So you can't stop. You don't have any ear lids in an oral society. But once you get writing, you then look at what someone said. You've changed the situation, but it becomes comfortable for the mind to think it's getting somewhere by stopping the flow of speech through what you read. And that has a service. That has a service. It creates lots of things that people can play with in their mental imaging. But, you know, people get carried away with their toys, and then they get into other unforeseen effects, like demanding their kids to go to school so they can learn how to read.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. We know how that turns out. What do you I just blanked for a second. I was going to say, what do you think about the whole school, as it were, of neuro-linguistic programming, which says that humans think in pictures, basically, and if you fuck with the pictures a lot, you can change people's perceptions. What do you think there is to that? That came from the TV environment, would you say?
Yeah. McLuhan said that the Generation X and the later generations did not think in the blank space of words by people who grew up with books. The imaging that the later present generations think in is from television, movies, and computers and video games. To actually see images, you just have to remember that people never saw these things before the photograph. They just saw, and they were a minority of people that read, they just saw black and white letters. That's the content of their mental imaging. So we shifted into imaging in this last part of the 20th century and first part of the 21st century. So the kids aren't too good at imaging in the empty black and white space of books. They never got conditioned by it. It wasn't something that fascinated them. It was a dead experience. So neurolinguistic programming is a fancy term, fancy ideology, dealing with the effects of the new media. But the problem with neurolinguistic programming, they don't tell you, like I and McLuhan and Finnings-Wake tell you, that the reason you are exploitable on the image level through neuralistic programming techniques is because you've been massaged on a bigger level by the electric environment to make you vulnerable to what's called right hemisphere living as opposed to left hemisphere abstraction.
Yeah, I think that's even above the pay grade of Richard Bandler and the NLP crew.
Right.
The entire environment. We definitely have dealt with the effects, but you know, it's good to know the cause. Not everyone wants to ask why, but yeah, it's many years of a buildup, growing a new organ, as you may say, or a new body inside your body of the television medium. And I was going to ask also, where does the Android meme come in specifically, time-wise?
Right. Okay, before I get into that, I was in the seminar at the McLuhan Coach House after McLuhan died. It was run by David Olson and Derek de Kerckhoff, professors at the University of Toronto. And one time in 82 or so, a Toronto musical composer came in, and he started talking about neurolinguistic programming. And this really excited Derek de Kerckhoff, who changed it to neurocultural programming when he brought in McLuhan ideas. It wasn't perfect McLuhan translation, but a McLuhanite heard neurolinguistic, which is dealing with mouth talk and face-to-face anticipation and ESP and manipulation and all that, you know, the way the eyes look up to the left or the right indicates some bias, that's dealing with a physical or chemical body. But de Kerckhoff saw that McLuhan was talking about cultural programming, that the whole North American culture was a kinetic visual culture, that Thailand and Japan were tactile cultures. So if you were going to talk to the whole population of Japan, you'd bring in a tactile bias that the Japanese could mirror off. So you'd mirror, you know, using those terms from neurolinguistic programming, which was just dealing with one-on-one individual manipulation for spy purposes originally, think of it on big neurocultural levels. And that's what McLuhan already had done. So what Bandler discovered was a nostalgia for the old chemical body and applying McLuhan knowledge to particular spoken interactions, the very thing we started this dialogue about, the mental dance and gesture of two people talking. But instead, McLuhan put it on vast collective levels.
Right.
And just that, if I went into a neurolinguistic programming seminar and said that, most people wouldn't know what to do with it, but the smart person in there would say, wait a minute, this is way better than Bandler's course, and they'd run off and be with me.
Yeah, I think the word linguistic in there is the problem, because it is beyond language at this point.
That's right. Linguistic usually means logocentric, you know, mouth talk or book talk.
Right. But conversation, you did say conversation is the sort of the best medium or the best art
right,
form.
And I don't mean, and that's conversation that's aware of our newer bodies. I know that I'm talking to a chip body and a TV body and an astral body as well as your chemical body. Most people don't know that. So it's conversation with a broader range and rhetoric of imagery that I'm using in my references, my frameworks. And that comes to the Android meme. The Android meme is, what happens after the satellite extended the whole planet, that's people able to live in a little house orbiting around the planet and not in a normal oxygen, hydrogen, terrestrial thing that we all have here on the planet, to go into an artificial little planet called a rocket ship or a satellite float out in the empty spaces. That is an extension of the terrestrial habitat we call Earth, all right? So that was the final extension, because all media were extensions of individual senses. The book was an extension of the eye. The radio an extension of the central nervous system. The wheel was an extension of the foot. These different parts of the body were superseded when the satellite didn't just extend our bodies, but the whole environment we were in. So that was the end point of human extensions in what I call the analog phase. And that happens in the 50s and 60s. After that, the digital technology is invented, and that's a medium that helps to extend all the older machines among themselves, not extending human body senses anymore. It's extending the environments of machines themselves, imploding them, miniaturizing them, evaporating them, speeding them up. That's the Android meme phase, where the what we used to call machines take over the evolution of technology. The previous evolution was just extending the human being's body and mind. So the Android meme is the machines talking to themselves. And the word machine is not even appropriate. That's too hardware-oriented. Call it software jelly extending itself.
Yeah, it's mecha goo. It's
well, Deleuze and Guattari, I think it was, came up with a better term. It's machinic. M-A-C-H-I-N-I-C, not machine. That's too hardware and like a noun. Machinic is the seamless process of digital networks interfacing. It looks like a machine.
This meme, this Android meme, it really is just that. It's a meme coming from the Android environment. It's not a human meme. It's,
right.
It's robots amongst themselves.
No, it's a good point to emphasize what I mean by meme. A meme is something that humans create, cultural habits, cultural ideas, sort of the big picture kind of stuff. That's a meme. But now that the machinic are talking to themselves, they actually move so fast, there's no concrete artifact created. It's usually just a pattern in the digital networks. So if you think of the meme as sort of an abstract pattern, the interface of the Android robots is they're not dealing with any hardware artifacts. They're dealing with patterns or memes. But it's a meme created within their interaction. So it's an Android meme, not a human meme. And it's only a meme. When we live at the speed of light and the speed of thought, we're only dealing with people trying to get a pattern of what's going on. That's the main work today. People turn on the TV, computer, whatever, to find out what's going on, to get a sense of the big picture, and it's a very futile effort if you don't know what I'm talking about, that people struggle around to find out what's the meme, the thought, the pattern of the day, right?
What's the virus?
What?
What is the viral meme?
Yeah, what's the virus thing that everybody is focusing on? That's why people, and you, if you don't keep track of it, you start to feel out of sync with everybody. Now, that's a valid way to be if you understand what you're out of sync with. I mean, I'm for getting out of sync and not paying attention to what the Android meme says, but you got to know all this background that I'm talking about before you make that lofty or dangerous leap of indifference to the patterns the Android meme's going to impose on you.
Yeah, they know not what they do. People don't know what's out there at all. I was going to ask to take this to a different plane. How does this Android meme and electric environment affect so-called paranormal activity or phenomena of the last whatever decades and today? I mean, are these creations of the jelly? Are they human?
No, that is the key. That's the key thing about understanding me. What did I create? What did Bob Dobbs be original about? I knew that McLuhan was saying that television was altering the image of the soul, the image of religiosity, the image of what prayer is, because he used to say that angels can be wherever they want to be, but wherever they go, that's the only place they're at. Then they go somewhere else, and then they're at some other place. The thing is,
right,
with the digital technology that humans created, not angels. Angels didn't create it. We created something where right now we could have 100 people listening to us, and we would be in their homes or wherever they are in their cars, and they would be with us in our room. You can't visualize the many places that we would be. So we would not be an angel. We'd be a super angel at many places at the same time. So just the digital effect or electronic discarnate effect weakens the charisma of the angelic image. And angels are like, you know, super beings that can be anywhere. Well, we can outdo that by being everywhere at the same time. So just thinking about that, and Marshall started talking about that in the late 60s, I knew that the what I later call the astral body, which is all the literature from the Quran, you know, the Jewish literature, the Christian, the Hindu, the Buddhist, the Zoroastrian, and even shamanistic oral tradition, all that stuff that talks about something else than the physical, I call the astral body of legacy. The astral body legacy was being altered by this, by what McClune was pointing out. So I was one of the first people, maybe the only person, to really begin to discuss that on popular culture talk shows, saying that the private citadel of consciousness was maybe going to be obliterated in some interesting way, even on the astral plane, or whatever we call these other places that we go to or have access to when we transition or before, all right? So that astral, and the astral body is all the literature and speculation and techniques of enjoying this era, this area that's not limited to the chemical body's physicality. So I talked about that 20 years ago, and I think that that's why I was part of the team that evoked ION, because ION has come forth to say this, that it, as representing the environment of heaven, what's called the guff. He's not a bunch of entities. He's the environment of the guff, or what's called the non-physical, that has come forth to be able to create, whereas the guff, the non-physical, couldn't create before. And the reason it can now create is because the chip landscape and the chip body is so unmanageable by human memes and human cultural control mechanisms that it allowed even our creations on the astral level to play in a new playground. And that's what I was talking and hinting at about, but I never knew it would show up like ION. But I give credit to William Irwin Thompson in his later books in the 90s. He started, and he was a good McLuhanite, he started to write the history of the image of the soul or the afterlife, and showing how the different media through the thousands of years changed the image people had of the afterlife. That's getting close to what I'm talking, what I was saying. So that is, your question is evoked. The essence of my creativity is figuring out how the theological ramifications, the post-human, or no, the afterlife implications of electronic tactility being extended. And ION has fulfilled that conversation that I was talking about for 20 years.
Right. It's a gathering process. You reap the seeds with this talk, and then it bloomed into this non-human thing.
Well, it's human. Humans created it, but it's not limited to the human physicality. It is something, Ion says, that humans couldn't take being eternal. They got themselves muddled up for, who knows, different reasons, and they fell, and therefore they wanted to leave this dimension, which was not comfortable for them anymore, where they were creative, and it's not comfortable anymore. So they created a space that they could commit suicide to and enter. And we call that the afterlife, or heaven, or where souls go. The bardos in Buddhist literature. That space was created by humans in a stressful time. And it's not necessary. And Ion's saying, and this is the amazing theological statement, that that environment is no longer going to be viable. You will not be able to go to another world. You will not be able to commit suicide. That's what's coming.
It's the eternal earth body here.
Yes, the physical body, but not limited to cultural images of what the physical is. And another way to say that is the non-physical will be included in what you think you look like. The non-visual of experience, call it anomalies that can't be rationally, linearly, writerly explained, will be part of your experience. The non-linear, the non-visual. That is another way of saying tactility will be part of your physical experience, so you won't be limited to what you see. And that's why Ion says, what you see is not real, what you don't see is real.
Now this involves basically the guff sort of opening up and spilling out and emptying out, and then there's no more separation between it and the physical world.
Yeah, there's no more container separate and outside of the container and the inside of the container.
Right.
The
so
walls are gone.
It's a corporate merger of cosmic proportions.
Right, and those are visual space images, cosmos. You think of the stars and that. Remember, the Aboriginals or the Hawaiians or the ancient peoples, they did not visualize. They already lived. Like Ion has said, that cavemen did not know they had feet. They didn't see their limbs. They were just like a nervous, responsive, sensitive membrane that was bouncing against other membranes. So they did not see the sky the way we think of the cosmos. So even those terms do not describe the tactile mud that we're retrieving here.
It's quite a lot to think about.
Visualize. It's quite a lot to visualize. And you more and more realize that visualizing it or, quote, understanding it is not appropriate to get what we're talking about.
It's more about autonomic responding, sensing it. It's more of a sense way to relate to things. Or
it's more and more understanding how dancing and tactility is not based on what you see. The more, and you know, people, the Chinese culture is a very tactile culture. What do? They do that Tai Chi. The citizens do it every morning. They kind of move around real slowly and try to feel the spaces in between. You know what I mean? It's right in their culture. They practice feeling, they practice not being fooled by their eyes.
Right. Feeling the chi. It's the,
yeah.
You can't see. You have to feel it. It's the only way is to experience and sense it.
And you watch. You've seen humor the last 40 years in Western culture is people running around with various revolutionary enthusiasms and different institutions and different psychologies all trying to feel the electric membrane, butch electron, trying to feel it. And they usually were trying to translate it into some way of seeing how they were feeling. And that's why you can make great humor of the New Age or the Esalen Institute human psychology movements, the forum, landmark training, all these things to get people to rely on their intuition. And you see, Ion makes a joke about that. He says, you don't have to try at what we're doing. Trying to develop your intuition, trying to get in touch with your non-physical, is trying to see and apply what is essentially not visible. It's just a sensory adjustment. And you have to rehearse the understanding of that, or the, as Ion says, the overlaying of that.
I can relate to that a lot because it seems like, at least in my life, my experience, when you do try, when you really try to grasp and focus on something, it slips away from you when you just do something because...
Yeah, so you know
you
what? Here's the main thing, which I bet you've done and most people have. The main way to get your feeling enhanced and get in touch with your feelings is to take drugs, whether it's Prozac, regular medical established drugs or recreational drugs or addictive drugs. Those are all attempts to put on and enhance your proprioceptive inner balancing mechanism. Those are rehearsals to feel.
It's right. It's to enhance your feelers. Your dinoflagellates.
Right. And often, you know, Terrence McKenna goes on about this. You see a hyper speed of images pass by you. Your inner kinetic imaging speeds up. You hear things that should be 10 miles away. So your visual parameters of normal 3D space are blown apart by the effect of psychoactive drugs or whatever drug you take. And that is an attempt, and McLuhan said this since the 50s, that's an attempt to adjust to the effect of the electric massage or the new extended non-physical.
It's a reference. It's a relational communication tool. It's all about how you respond to your environment, right? If you're you're swimming in the right pool, seems to be. That's why people need to take these Prozacian type drugs or anything to sort of.
They're trying to anchor themselves. They're trying to slow down the non-visual communication that's being radiated around them in all the media, in all the digital environments. So you either try to balance, try to slow down and anchor yourself in some visual space, and that explains obesity. People are becoming obese because they're trying to create more gravity in their physical body, their chemical body, as they intuit that there's a lot swimming around them that they don't like, you know, that they can't visualize, they can't keep up with, they can't get a position in relation to. So when you say relational, an important statement by McLuhan is, he was asked, will there ever be silence? And he said, objects are unobservable, meaning the object or endpoint of silence is not observable. Only relationships between objects are observable. And that means the spaces between objects are what you notice. And then the different media change how you notice the space. But there are no nouns. There are no objects. Literacy, now here's what you got to know next, is literacy did make you think there were objects. That was the effect of the...
This is obtuse. This is where the academic kids would say, oh, gosh, that now they are being very abstract
We don't need to quote the academics. What are academics today? They're bureaucrats trying to help kids get conditioned to have a job. And efficiency is their main thing. They just got to pass the courses and look like they know the memes of the day. It's just a checking, a plastic surgery for the mind. So academics are not something to be respectable, to be respected too much. They're just functionaries, bureaucrats, and the plantations of the mind, which is the information society. Do you notice that the new phenomenon, and McLuhan wrote about this in the early 70s, said the new phenomenon is a guy like Kissinger. A professor, a government bureaucrat, a political negotiator, and a spy, all thrown in, four different functions. A mere professor in a university is a loser, is a limited specialist. And so you have people like Kissinger going forth, and they want to be influential in the new classroom without walls, the new university without walls, the global theater, so they leave their teaching position and get into politics. And then rise up and get some backing from the Rockefellers or somebody so that they can be at the position in the National Security Agency to determine what the big patterns that people have to learn about. See, so it's not academics that we have to worry about as an establishment that we have to measure up to. We have to measure up to the rogue academics like the Henry Kissingers who recognize it's an information environment where you're to create, you want influence and power, you create the interpretation of what to do in Iraq or what to do with Afghanistan or what to do with SOPA, you know, the present legislation. The big picture that advises the president is where the real university or what we used to call academic position is now. You follow what I'm saying here?
I do indeed. I mean, I was just going to comment that, academia is just the lowest rung on the government
on the information society in the software world since World War II. Now, Finnegan's Wake talks about it as a brain trust in the 30s. FDR had a brain trust. Now, another aspect is we don't want to have some university professor agree or think Bob is relevant. I want to get Mr. Kissinger or Mr. Obama or whoever in some intelligence level to accept my pattern and use it. Because they are the influential information processors. We're not, and they know that they only have authority, the authority of knowledge, if they can control the microphone and say what is. So today the battle is between very sophisticated pattern makers over the microphone at the White House. And it's a battle over who gets to say whether UFOs landed yesterday or not. And that's a big picture, a big pattern that the global classroom is waiting for the teacher to tell us whether it happened or not, right? And it's that position that we present ION as an antidote to. I used to do on James' show before ION showed up, I used to do this thing. You had the State of the Union address. Well, I tried to counter the State of the Union address by calling it the Union of the Stated address. So every Wednesday came on and gave, pretended or claimed or was actually the creator of the patterns of accuracy in the global theater.
Yeah, basically it's the president when they give the State of the Union, it's like you said, we're waiting for them to tell us what's literally already been written and known and record. Like, they know what they're going to say. It's recorded what they're going to say a few days out before they even say it. But
well, it's a heavy responsibility, because the phrase, you might have heard me say, the word makes the market. What the president says determines the harmonic climates, which are the musical content of Zappa's work. The harmonic climates, the media climates, said by the White House, it said, you know, remember the despondency when Obama said we're not pulling out of Afghanistan. We're sending troops in there. That caused 4 billion suicides, right? For all those that thought that he would bring in peace or not so much warlike industrial movement. So anyway,
right.
The importance of that statement, yes, it's what the White House is. That's the only job of the White House, is to figure out how to speak and determine and define the big patterns. That's its job. And they have millions of advisors and millions of conferences and millions of secret meetings to figure out what Obama's going to say next Wednesday.
Right, right. And you were involved in a lot of this stuff, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Throughout many, and still are, perhaps. I don't know whether you can say
I still
not.
Am, but the Secret Council of 10, which I was part of and then later in charge of, we were the ones who represented the historical wealth of the ages, what's called the Fondi, the wealthiest hidden people who some people like to call the Illuminati, historical wealth. It goes back 400, 600, 700 years. We were on the sidelines because, or the people that I represented were on the sidelines because money was no longer private property. It was public property when you had the welfare states starting in the 1930s. Different versions of welfare state. You had the FDR New Deal. You had European socialism or Russian communism or Italian fascism. These are different forms of collective possession of the money properties. So when money was sidelined, then the historical oligarchy could only observe and monitor what new technologies were coming in that would change the situation. So we didn't control what the White House said, but we watched what new inventions, what new advisors, what new rogue intellectuals or artists or creators told the White House to say. That's what we monitored them, and we had access to the inner realms of avant-garde decision making. That's what we monitored. But it all fell apart by the late 70s, and even the American century, signified by the Rockefellers, couldn't hold the global theater together, and that's when it fell back to the oligarchy, who had some money, historical money, to sort of smooth out the 80s, the transition to the 80s, and that was Prince Charles's role. He represented that. But then that collapsed as the Android meme took over in the 90s. And that's why I disbanded Secret Council 10 in 1990, knowing we'd have to wait, like we always did in the Secret Council 10, to see what new technology would come in to get us out of the dominance of the Android meme phase, because nobody had any control of the Android meme phase. And that turned out to be ION.
And is this guff spilling, ionic merging? How is it affecting all this governmental?
It's affecting all of it. First of all, it collapses it all.
Say again.
It makes the collapse of their patterns and big picture imaging. It collapses all that.
Well, that's clear.
It makes it not viable. It starts telling everybody that there is no money, even though the Fed, which is not legally allowed to do this, will pump out billions of dollars into the economy or claim it is doing. And just by saying that, those that want to believe and live in that old environment will think, oh, okay, yeah, there's some money coming. But then they'll be upset when it doesn't show up, and they'll get mad at Goldman Sachs for ripping it off. And journalists like Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-I, will get a little headway in the Rolling Stone complaining about this, but not understanding that there is no money to monitor anymore, and there is no digital exchange. We actually don't know what the new currency is. I say that ION is the new currency and its products.
Oh, the RNA.
Yeah, RNA drops, which is the best stuff you can take for anything.
Right. I've been meaning to get my hands on the next bottle. had some profound effects on me before.
Right, and it's very individual. It's so ecological. It's like we were talking about earlier about people taking drugs to try to keep up with the extended tactility. But all kinds of disservices and bad side effects happen as a result of that. This is the best drug to tune you in to the extension of tactility today. It has no side effects.
It's what Trent Reznor called the perfect drug in the mid-90s, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, it's the perfect drug. Now, because we can't standardize what the effects will be, we don't know what the effects will be on each individual. And the other good news is that, yes, you will have individual reactions different from mine, but they are not permanent. There'll be newer reactions from later issues of the stuff. It's an ongoing, what the evergreens defined as the second coming, a time of perpetual change. The RNA drops ride that perpetual change and maybe even stimulate it.
Riding that train high on cocaine.
Yeah. What song is that? Sounds familiar.
That's The Grateful Dead.
Oh, yeah, right. What was that called? Truckin' or something?
I believe it's something like that, yeah. Right. Truckin', ride the truck, some sort of thing. But, yeah, it's sort of that smooth, as to use their catchphrase, the long, strange trip. What is their phrase? Yeah, what a long, strange trip it's been. And it's sort
right.
of like, it's all led to right now, right here, 2012, if that is the real time, if there is time, which you guys say there's not.
Last year. We're now in 2013. Last year, 2011 was the events of 2012 that everybody's waiting for.
I can buy that. I can see that. Now, why explain that little hiccup in year?
Well, you know, when in writing or calendar or literate terms, when you're 1 year old, and then the next 12 months, the kid says, when asked how old, they say they're one. They're actually not one. They're actually 1.1, 1.2. They're becoming two. So they're actually in the process of two-ness from the moment of their first birthday. So they should start saying, I'm two. And then the two ends when they complete the 24 months, and then they're three, even though culture tells you to say you're two. So we arrived in 2012 in 2011. 2011, the past 12 months, were part of, technically in literate calendar terms, was the unfolding of 2012. That was the environment we're in. We completed 2011 when we started 2011.
Absolutely. And I think that basically what people talk about in the 2012, you know, cycle, whatever, what the Mayans were talking about and all this, I think what has happened in the last year qualifies for fulfilling that prophecy. I mean, basically, the way I read it is it really just talked about a mass shift in consciousness, a mass awakening, whatever you want to call it.
And a mass disaster. Look at the Japanese earthquake and the Nevada problems. They are not talked about in the media, but everybody, if anybody looks into them, can get real paranoid that it is making radioactivity be everywhere. Now, ion's the only thing that provides an antidote to that. The RNA drops are an antidote to all this bad news in the past 12 months. And ION said it began in December 21st, 2010, was the beginning of the year of the Jubilee, and the winds were unleashed on January 12th, 2011. And the winds blew this whole year. And that's all predicted in the Bible, in the Book of Revelation. This important.
Yeah,
and it began with the, what kind of moon? The red moon? The blood moon. The blood moon on December 21st, 2010.
Yep. Yeah, this Fukushima radiation reactor, you know, stuff. That could very well be the death of everyone in the typical world, you know, this mass extinction. According to what Ion said basically that the 99% would get their ass roasted by radiation. But
right, and Ion's not being a doom. He's offering an antidote to being roasted, and that's the RNA drop. See, that's the incredible thing. There's not one institution in the world that will admit the tragedy of what happened in Japan, and if they did, they don't have a solution for it. We actually claim to have a solution. Now, people won't believe it, probably, but a few lucky people engage it and feel like they're getting something from it.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw a commercial, maybe it was online on YouTube or something recently, which summed up this whole philosophy, if you want to call it that, where this, you know, teenage sort of kid, he's walking down the street listening to his headphones, and everything's, like, fucking exploding around him, like, you know, just the entire planet's crumbling around him, but he could care less. He's just on his headphones, walking
right.
around, going to the bus stop or whatever. And yeah, that I think that sums up at least in my interpretation of what this message seems to
be. Yeah,
mean.
I wouldn't be surprised if the guys who made that ad might have heard Ion talking about that.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. It also related to the movie Inception in the sense that there's sort of a scene like that where they're in
yeah.
a dream world and everything starts exploding around them and they're like, well, you know, yeah, it's not real. It's just you got to recognize it's bullshit. You know, even though
it's
the
what you see. What you see is not real.
Right, right. And so you can, if you're amongst that, you can be amongst it but not affected by it. Which,
right. And
very
it's tricky. Brutal. You pretty what?
Yeah. I said it's very, you could say, you're saying it's tricky, but to
you
be started
to say it's pretty cool. What'd you say? Pretty.
I said it's pretty Buddhist, actually.
Yeah, yeah, Buddhist. But here's the thing, is that you don't put yourself in a position or preparedness to be that way. See, because you're reacting. I said, uh-oh, there's all this stuff exploding, and I pretend I don't see it. I'm ignoring it. You literally have to not notice it. And the Buddhist is reacting to a situation and providing an antidote.
They are, yeah, it's a reactionary thing in a sense rather than a what we might call.
Not even knowing there is an issue. Not even knowing there was an issue.
Well, yeah, I've heard you guys talk about it. Like, if you want to put yourself in a less than position and say, I'm reacting or I'm fighting.
I'm going to save myself. I'm going to adopt an Ionic philosophy and relax and allow. That's still noticing there's a problem that you're trying to solve.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's like, it's the constant dualistic hemispheric us versus them, 99 versus 1%.
Yeah, me versus my demise.
Yeah, me versus you versus your lion eyes, you know. And
yeah.
Now,
here's an interesting thing. This thing I'm talking about, of not reacting, is what the media environment does. The Android meme is already acting on that very advanced level. It's what Ion is referring to is the actual characteristics of the present environment. If McClone was alive and had kept on what was going, he'd describe the new environment the way I am, because the new environment has nothing to do with chemical bodies. The chemical bodies are not involved in this Android meme thing, and we're watching it keep itself going, and we watch how it doesn't stop at any particular point. It just keeps creating information. It is in a flow. It's like the first word of Finning's Wake, River Run. And this flow of the Android meme is a perfect utopic condition of consciousness. And the chemical body is finding a hard time figuring out its relationship to that. And Ion is helping people get a relationship to that. And so it's not making up woo-woo statements about metaphysical ideas that one needs to ignore the apocalypse. It's actually describing how the news today ignores the apocalypse. There's not a story that it ever stops at.
The ongoing apocalypse.
Yeah.
All right. I wanted to wrap this up so we can make it concisely enough to actually upload and have people listen to it. But obviously it's on you to finish the actual recording portion of the show. We're at about 1:16 right now.
Okay. Let me wrap this up. I would say this, that what I'm talking about what you learn about me if you're interested, it's not easily summarized. It's not a quick package. This is an ongoing process. I recommend checking me out for many years. You can go back and listen to the archive. Not to distract you, but what we're talking about is a training of perception that you don't get immediately. Though we are helped today by Ion, who says, forget Bob's training of perception, take the RNA drops, and you're better off than listening to Bob. I acknowledge that. But people like to pretend, their minds like to know how it happened. How did we get here? Well, that's what I offer. And it's not a simple paragraph.
Absolutely. For all the unenlightened out there, they should take the RNA drops, rnadrops.com, right?
Yeah.
And go to the Bob full timeline, full archive, and that is fivebody.com/archive. Is that it?
No, it's have them email you or something to get the actual long URL. If you went to fivebodied.com,
yeah,
under the first section called Being Five Bodied, I think one of the first stickies or the first topics is the complete timeline. But it's not just that. It's better to go to howionic.com and listen to the 2 years plus radio shows we've done. That's the latest fun stuff.
Oh, right. Yes, How Ionic. I see what the full URL is. It's not that crazy, but yeah, it's certainly.
What is it? Say it off. It is fivebody.com in the beginning.
fivebody.com/archive/audio/catalog/complete-bob-timeline.com.
Right.
So
that is me before Ion, but our radio show is challenging enough. At How Ionic, I-O-N-I-C, howionic.com. Go listen. Just click on any of the radio archives and be entertained. It's very interesting.
Yep, all you motherfuckers should do that. And, yeah.
Yeah, if there's anything you should do, we're not into shooting on people. We're not into shooting on people, but this is the last should. Get into Dobbstown. That's the last should you should do.
Coulda and coulda. Yeah, get into Dobbstown, exactly. That's what would be a nice suggestion for, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt. It's a lot of fun.
Whoever may come across this.
Yes.
Yeah, with one of their buds. But yeah.
Okay, so shall I end? Do you want to make a final statement, or shall I just end?
My final statement is, yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm glad this is the first, the inaugural edition of whatever the hell this may be. I will definitely be posting this and, you know, trying to spread it out there. And, yeah, hopefully there's more sessions to come. I have no personal message to the world. I'm being objective. But, yeah, that is.
You just know who to talk to.
Yeah, exactly. And if I can summon the gumption, I'll probably make a transcript of this so we can, so, you know, it'll just be a different medium.
Different translation. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think it works. Yeah, a different translation, and it could work in a different way for those people out there. So yeah, no need to do a typical radio or show sign off or anything like that. It's just whenever, whenever's clever, wrap it up. And
okay, so I'll press the thing.